Call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. A quorum, though scattered, is present. And the first order of business would be to approve the minutes of the last meeting. Representative Johnson moves approval. Any additions or corrections? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are approved. First item on the agenda is House File 774. Representative Dill, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Chair Hilty. It's the first time I've been before the Energy Committee. I was wondering if I could get a discount coupon for unleaded gasoline before I leave.
I'm checking that up later.
One of our members, move House File 774, please.
Yes, the Chair will move that House File 774 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Ag Finance Committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Hilty. And this is about renewable energy. This is about the beginning process of cellulosic ethanol up in the wooded area of the state. And with me, I have members, or I have representatives from the Boys Fort Reservation, and they will explain the bill briefly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty, representatives. My name is Andrew Datko. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Boys Fort Development, which is the business division of the Boys Fort Reservation. And also with me is George Johnson, Senior Scientist with SEH Incorporated, who are our technical consultants on this project. First of all, I would like to pass on regards and apologies from Chairman Kevin Lisi. Tribal Chairman had planned to be here, but due to the rescheduling of the hearing, I had a prior out-of-town commitment that he had to attend. But had he been here, he wanted to give some just general opening remarks in regards to who the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa are and where the reservation is, and I'll talk in some detail about this project. The Boys Fort Reservation is located in northeastern Minnesota, about 50 miles south of International Falls, about 20 miles west of Orr, Minnesota. That's the main portion of the reservation up around Net Lake. There's also a smaller portion of the reservation on Lake Vermilion. The Boys Fort band is a relatively small band. There's about 3,000 members. The reservation at Net Lake is remote. It's rural. Its resources primarily consist of forestry resources, forestry and wild rice. In spite of many efforts over the years at economic development, which have been successful, there's still a fairly high unemployment rate on the reservation, approximately 40%. But the band has made many efforts to build its economy and to diversify its economy. Most of that activity has taken place on the Lake Vermilion portion of the reservation. We do have a small resort casino, Fortune Bay Resort Casino, but over the last half a dozen years or so have made a real effort to diversify the economy away from just reliance on that. And so we have developed a golf course. We have acquired WELY, End of the Road Radio Station, in Ely, Minnesota. We have acquired a small manufacturing company in Tower, Minnesota, called Power Rain, and we have a couple of convenience stores. All told, between those enterprises and the government activities, the band employs about 700 people, and about 70% of those employees are non-Indians from the surrounding communities. Several months ago, we were approached by members of the surrounding communities, people involved in economic development, to talk about what could the Boys Fort Band and the reservation do to help jumpstart the economy in northeastern Minnesota. And out of those discussions came this idea for a renewable energy project. And Voice Fork, by the way, does have a history of collaboration with surrounding communities and with the state. As an example, Voice Fork has utilized tribal resources and federal transportation dollars to leverage against state transportation dollars for improvements to some state highway improvements in the area, allowing us to accomplish together what we would not have been able to accomplish alone. We also, in initiating this renewable energies project, we approached Iron Range Resources Agency and received a planning grant of $25,000, which the band matched, and were thus able to retain SEH and begin the process of getting our arms around what this project could look like. And in your packet, I do believe there is a copy of the executive summary of the scoping document, which has been prepared. With those introductory remarks aside, I'll talk a little more detail about the project. The Boys Fork Band of Chippewa intends to develop a demonstration facility on its reservation that will convert cellulosic biomass into biofuels such as ethanol and butanol. We want to work with the state and our neighboring communities to make this project a success so that it benefits everyone in the region. We are here today seeking $300,000 in state assistance for a technical and economic feasibility study for this project. This project would improve energy self-sufficiency on the reservation and throughout northeastern Minnesota by using locally available renewable resources. This would reduce our dependence on foreign petroleum for transportation and heating. And because petroleum and other fossil fuels contribute to global warming, using more renewable biofuels will reduce harmful carbon emissions and help the environment. Other key benefits of the project include the creation of new jobs and the strengthening of the band's economy as well as that of our region. As you know from your work on this committee, the market for biofuels is growing exponentially, and biofuels are emerging as a vital technology for our state and the nation. The study that we are proposing will examine many factors, including an assessment of the sustainable biomass resources on tribally controlled lands and also within the surrounding area. These would be things such as logging residues, forest trimmings, pulp mill and sawmill waste, and processed municipal waste. We will look at optimal project size, configuration, and location, technology options and system configurations, siting and environmental considerations and permitting criteria, end market options for the types of biofuels to be produced, possible synergistic alliances with energy users and biomass producers, leading to additional economic benefits for the region, and pro forma financial projections and a long-term business plan. We have done extensive preliminary research into this emerging field with the assistance of SEH consulting engineers, and we've also been working in consultation with the Natural Resources Research Institute, which is part of the University of Minnesota in Duluth. We have prepared a detailed scoping document that identifies specific technologies to be examined in greater detail, with the end result of this whole process being the selection of the most appropriate technology and development of a demonstration plant. And in that scoping document, in that process, we identified well over a dozen technologies that appear to have real potential as being viable for the kinds of biomass resources that we have available, and we've targeted about a half a dozen that we want to explore in more detail in the technical feasibility study. The scoping document indicates that cellulosic biofuels technologies are being developed at a rapid pace, and the time is right to develop a demonstration-scale cellulosic biofuels facility in Minnesota. In keeping with the deep respect and spiritual relationship Native Americans have with their environment, Boys Fork is committed to generating sustainable economic development that is environmentally appropriate. We know that corn-derived ethanol is an important fuel, but there is already beginning to be competition for corn as fuel versus corn as food. Our proposal would generate energy from renewable local resources that do not hold value as competing vital resources, such as farm commodities. Cellulosic sources of ethanol, butanol, and other biofuels offer greater long-term potential for energy independence. Cellulosic feedstock resources are much more common and readily available, and the research shows that the conversion efficiencies of cellulose to ethanol are much higher than that of corn-derived ethanol. We intend to develop a project that is environmentally suitable and sized appropriately for the available feedstock resources. The scale of the project will be on the order of 1 to 4 million gallons of biofuels annually. We believe that this size facility can be operated on a sustainable basis with locally produced renewable sources of biomass feedstock. The project provides the opportunity to strengthen partnerships among the band, the state, the federal government, and local counties and towns. And as Boysport has proven, successful collaboration between governmental units is often a catalyst for economic growth in the region. We are therefore requesting your assistance in the spirit of cooperation and partnership to help move this project forward. We have already committed substantial time and effort to this project, and we strongly believe that upon completion of the feasibility study, we will be able to leverage the state and the band's commitment to obtain federal funds to develop the demonstration plant. And just as an aside there, we do know that the Federal Department of Energy is going to be pouring millions of dollars into cellulosic biofuels research and demonstration plants, and some portion of those resources will be set aside for projects on Indian lands. And so we believe as we get through the technical and economic feasibility study, we will really have a strong case to be able to leverage this first step effort into the more substantial resources required to actually develop this project. Thank you for your time. Myself and Mr. Johnson are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions from members? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dill, or whoever is, would like to address the question. I'm wondering why you're narrowing the legislation to some specific areas when you potentially could accomplish the same thing, but leave your future options open. For example, when I see you addressing cellulosic waste, what if the cellulosic material is not a waste? It was actually something other than what you may currently have in your scope, but it may become an option in the future. I'm wondering if there wouldn't be more advisable. One of the biggest reasons I'm raising the question, Mr. Chair, is that in consultation with the University of Minnesota, they keep warning me, as well as others, don't pick winners and losers. Keep your legislation broad. Keep it very, for everything you do, keep it the scope wide open. So if a new technology comes along tomorrow that you didn't envision today, you don't have to go back for new legislation. You can just make the logical switch and just continue on. And a couple of words that you're using seems to narrow your focus. For example, cellulosic waste, why shouldn't it be cellulosic materials? It says to produce ethanol and or butanol, why are you not saying just biofuels? There was as a liquid fuel, why aren't you just saying as a fuel source? So in case it may be gasification and rather than liquid. I'm just wondering if you've considered those and there's reasons why you haven't gone that direction.
Yes, sir. Chairman Hilty, Representative Osmond. Those are all very good observations. I can assure you that in terms of the types of feedstocks that we want to look at, we have talked about in our report looking at forest residuals, waste products, things of that type, but we have certainly not ruled out any sources of cellulose. And basically, from a chemical standpoint, Mr. Johnson could attest to this better than I, cellulose is cellulose. And one of the things that we do want to look at is that given the relatively large land base that Boysport has, there is the opportunity to harvest and possibly even grow woody biomass, shrubs, for example, on land that's set aside specifically for that purpose. So it wouldn't necessarily be a waste product. It might be biomass that's actually grown for that purpose. But one of the things we do want to avoid is getting into a situation where we're competing for roundwood, for example. Now, this plant, if it can convert woody biomass, could also convert roundwood. But from a market point of view, there may be a higher and better use of logs for building materials, paper, pulp, that sort of thing. So that's why in our material we've tended to focus on the types of materials that are currently not really being used for anything else, because we think that has the most potential. In terms of the actual fuels to be produced, Again, I think you you really hit the nail on the head. We are talking about ethanol and butanol or other biofuels. One of the reasons that the focus would be on ethanol is simply that that's the market that's been established. But long term, it may not be the best fuel to produce. There may be other fuels, and the technologies that we're looking at would be capable of producing those as well. And that's part of what we want to identify in this more detailed feasibility study is precisely what would the market mix be of those potential fuels.
Chair.
Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, I take that as a real constructive piece of criticism on the language on the last three or four lines. And we have, before our next stop, we're going to roundtable that idea and see how we can, actually what we'd be doing is enabling, being more enabling than this particular document. So I appreciate that, and serving with you, under you as vice chair, I learned a lot from you and how you see these things, and I didn't, so thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Yes, Representative Osmond.
Well, thank you, Representative Dill, for that, and I am trying to be constructive in the, my experience is that when we're, your first part of the language is directing the Commissioner of Agriculture to be the fiscal agent. And when they are going to take a look at law as to what they're authorized to have you spend money on, they can say, well, yes, it's cellulosic, but it's not waste. And it can be, when you put something in law, it can be very problematic unless you give yourself the flexibility for the fiscal agent to be able to say, yes, and that's what the legislation or the legislators encompassed in their concepts of what they were trying to intending to go forward with. So the broader you are, the better off you will be. And I would encourage you to work with staff to find that kind of language. Is it some of your, just like if you wanted to have ethanol and or butanol or other biofuels, that automatically that opens you wide up to what you were saying.
Good advice. Thank you, Representative Bosman. Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, just visiting with some of the proponents in my office, they said this would be a study that the state would be able to have. Is that your understanding? And I just wanted to make sure that if we were to go ahead with this kind of funding of a technical feasible study, that indeed we'd have that information in the future for other plants that may want to also start up, so they maybe could jump start or skip past some of these expensive parts or not have to spend as much on it. Is that your intent? And second question, I've got a facility, and I also visited with the folks in Morris that's putting together a biomass project for heating and cooling plant on the UMM campus, and they've got some of the technical feasible issues of how to collect this and what's the technical and practical effect of bringing all the biomass in to make this. And so will they be partnering with a group like that to help broaden this out so everybody can learn along the way and we can have a document in the end that would be beneficial more than just to this plant?
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Chair Hildy. Representative Western, very good question. First, the intellectual portion that you questioned about in the first section of your questions was, yes, the information will be available for others to use through the state if and when this is accomplished. That has always been the intent. Second question regarding the, which is really a kind of a barrier in terms of, in my opinion, a barrier to actually getting ethanol made by woody biomass, because it's kind of plowing new ground, so to speak, or harvesting new ground, is the collection and how do you transport it economically and how do you bundle it and all of those things. And the band has been working with the Natural Resources Research Institute on that, which is another state agency. And that information as well will be broadly, be disseminated and be available to assist things like, for example, Representative Rukavina and Representative Sertich Biomass Project, Laurentian Biomass Project. They have the same types of problems that the ethanol industry will have in collecting biomass. So the answer to both of your questions is yes.
Thanks.
Representative Hoppe?
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from members? If not, the chair will renew his motion that House File 774 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Bill is re-referred.
Then they'd have something to do.
Next on the agenda, members, we have a discussion on decoupling, and we are fortunate to have with us today Mr. Wayne Shirley, who has some impressive credentials on this topic. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Shirley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Galen, did you have something to say?
Surprise, Mr. Chair. I never do, but thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Just a quick little context for discussion today. I believe next week, currently, depending on how the chess pieces work out, we'll be taking up the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Bill, and Representative Gunther, appreciate your help on the bill and others. A key piece of the discussion that we'll be having, you know, the governor has called us to move from spending money on conserving energy to actually conserving energy and measuring that. And it's an important goal to get us to results. It does have some important economic implications, and a key linchpin, the kingpin of making this all happen is decoupling, to move to tweak our economy when we're talking about utilities, to make sure that we can continue the revenue stream for our utility partners, but start rewarding them for doing the right thing rather than making it more and more difficult for them to do what I think they want to do, which is to join us in the effort to conserve energy. So even this morning in our stakeholder meeting, it came more and more clear that every single time we talked about one of the pieces of the bill that we'll be bringing before this committee, it all comes back to decoupling. And so can be a difficult concept to talk about, but Mr. Shirley is really good at making it accessible to us. And so just as we look forward to next week, it's a real honor to have Mr. Shirley here, and appreciate you taking the long trek to help us learn from experience and also move ahead in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And while you're here, Mr. Shirley, we'll try to give you as good a sample of Minnesota weather as we can.
I think we're about to get to that.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. My name is Wayne Shirley. I work for the Regulatory Assistance Project, which is more commonly known as RAP. RAP is a nonprofit organization composed of former utility regulators from Vermont, Maine, and I'm from New Mexico. We are funded primarily through grants from the Energy Foundation, the U.S. Department of Energy, and U.S. EPA. And our services are directed toward public officials, primarily public utility commissions around the country, but also legislative bodies such as this. And we generally don't charge for this kind of service. I'm here through that grant process rather than through the fee. I want to obviously talk about decoupling, but in order to explain what decoupling is and the problem that it solves, it's really necessary to have some understanding of current rate-making process for public utilities. And in this post-lunch, mid-afternoon time zone, I hope I don't put everyone to sleep with this discussion, because it can be rather arcane. I'll try to make it as transparent as I can. When we set utility prices for utilities, it's really based upon a concept we call cost of service regulation, in which we look at a utility's operations, we add up all of its operating expenses, we look at the capital it's invested and the return requirements associated with that capital. We add those numbers together and come up with something we call the revenue requirement. That revenue requirement, in simple terms, is then divided by the units of sales in that same time period that we looked at. And from that, you derive the appropriate price. The assumption being that you've taken a snapshot of this utility and it represents a fair consideration of its operations on an ongoing basis, and that price has been put into effect. Once that process is complete, what really happens has very little to do with what you looked at in the rate case. That's because the actual sales that take place may be higher or may be lower than what you assumed from the test period that you looked at in the rate case. We don't go back and retroactively assure that the utility recovers its appropriate profit, nor do we refund over-earnings if that takes place. The solution when we get out of kilter is to have a new rate case and start the process over again. Typically, utilities will see rate cases on a 3 to 5 year kind of time frame, assuming that they're more or less on that target rate of return for most of that period, but it typically as that return goes down through growth and investments, they'll come back in for a new rate case. This relationship between sales volume and revenues obviously translates to profits. So the utility obviously is in the business of making profits, and it has two choices to increase profits. It can attempt to decrease its expenses, or it can increase sales. And in this kind of business, a good deal of the expenses of the utility are largely fixed. And so it's difficult for a utility to increase profits by decreasing expenses. Not impossible, but difficult. It's much easier for a utility to increase its profits by encouraging consumption. And that's typically what we have seen both in both the gas and the electric industry. This relationship is what we call the throughput problem or the throughput issue. And it gets to the core problem in terms of deploying energy efficiency or having demand response or distributed generation for that matter on the system, because any of those activities will reduce consumption and therefore reduce the revenues and the profits of the utility. Because the utilities are highly capitalized with debt and because their expenses are largely fixed between rate cases, the profits are highly sensitive to small changes in revenues. So take, for example, a typical utility, a 5% change in revenues may cause up to a 50% change in the magnitude of profits for that utility. Obviously, this is something that's going to get management's attention, and they're going to be very defensive about things that reduce those revenues and very proactive about things that increase those revenues. So there's an inherent conflict in our existing regulatory framework that works against what I think we all agree, including utilities, are good public policies, favoring cleaner resources and favoring energy efficiency. So decoupling is a concept that was developed to address this very problem. It removes the disincentives that the utility faces, which causes them to oppose energy efficiency, and it removes the incentive that they have to increase consumption in order to increase their profits. Decoupling is a technique that's really a minor modification or extension of the traditional regulatory process. Whereas in the regular rate case, you take, at the end of the process, you have this revenue requirement and you divide by the consumption units to get a price. We have one additional calculation that we do after that, and that is to compute what the average revenue per customer is for each class of customers, residential, small commercial, large industrial, and so forth. With that number, on an ongoing forward basis, you can then compute an allowed revenue requirement based upon that average revenue per customer. So that in the future, if the company has added more customers, the allowed revenues go up slightly. But we also then divide by the current consumption at that future period to compute what the price should be so that the utility recovers that appropriate revenue amount. This limits the windfalls associated from inefficient consumption that the utility gets by increasing sales, and it eliminates the shortfalls the utility would experience through such things as energy efficiency, which drives down the sales. That, in a nutshell, is the basics of decoupling. The key point to understand, I think, is that the utility's profits are still not guaranteed. It's still a function of what their actual expenses are subtracted from their actual revenues. But we have now created a construct where the revenues are more a function of the number of customers, which more closely tracks how expenses change between rate cases. And we've taken away this threat to their profits from embracing energy efficiency. Decoupling should only be embraced, in my view, if you're also embarking on an aggressive energy efficiency program. It's not something you want to do just because it's a nice theory. It's really targeted toward this incentive issue relative to energy efficiency. And the reason energy efficiency is important here is because, and here I'll use an electric utility example because I think it's easier to explain the concept. At any given time, the utility is required to balance exactly the supply and the demand. So when someone turns a light switch on, there has to be a power plant somewhere running that provides the kilowatt hours to supply that energy. This balancing that has to take place can really take place in two different ways in a system planning sense. You can either build more supply-side resources, power plants, transmission lines, distribution lines, transformers, and so forth. Or you can reduce consumption through energy efficiency. Either one of those will bring the system back into balance. And it's a fairly obvious condition of the economics that energy efficiency is the cheapest way to achieve that balance. A new power plant may come online and serve customers at, let's say, 8 cents a kilowatt hour. That's somewhere in the range of what we're likely to be seeing for new power plants. To that, you might have to add the cost of transmission and distribution. So the effective cost of supplying power may be on the order of 9 or 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Most energy efficiency that's achievable today and in the near future is in the cost range of 2 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which is drastically lower than the cost of building new supply-side resources. So there's a compelling economic reason for the state's economy and for customers to really go after aggressively the energy efficiency solution rather than the supply-side solution to this problem. I do have several notes. I don't want to miss anything here. I want to address real quickly how the effect of changes in consumption translate into changes in prices in the decoupling mechanism. This is a little bit of math, and sometimes it's hard to get your mind around what's going on here. But let's just assume that we've determined the utility's entitled to recover $1 million from a given rate class, and that before we had any change in consumption through efficiency, you were selling 25 million units of either decatherms on the gas side or kilowatt hours on the electric side. This would translate into a 4 cent unit price for that service. If a customer or several customers engaged in energy efficiency such that consumption was reduced by, let's say, 1.5%, the effect, if you had no change in price, would be a decline in revenues of $15,000 from that rate class. So what decoupling does is it modifies the price slightly. It increases the price to bring the revenues back up to $1 million for that whole rate class. So in this case, when you work through the math, the price goes from 4 cents to 4.06 cents and a few more digits. But the point is, it's a slight modification in price. These modifications can be done periodically, either monthly, quarterly, annually. We recommend monthly because it makes these changes smoother, and you don't get lumpy effects where suddenly you've built up a big amount and then you have a bigger price change. So from a customer's standpoint, I think it's a friendlier regime to do it on a more regular basis. Finally, I want to talk about some misconceptions about decoupling. One of which relates to the issue I just discussed, this change in price. Because some people think, well, this means that the customer who's gone out and invested in energy efficiency now sees a higher bill, and it takes away the gains from the efficiency. But when you work through the math, that's not right, because what happens is the change in consumption is spread across the entire rate class. And so there is a slight rise in price, but as compared to the savings that customer sees, it's a very small percentage of that number. The other thing to take note of is that these adjustments are done only with respect to the fixed costs of the system, mostly the delivery costs, but in the case of the electric industry, this includes the investments in power plants, if you have a vertically integrated utility, which is what you have here. And it doesn't apply to the commodity itself. So in the gas industry, the gas molecules that the customer saves, they retain all of the savings from that reduction in consumption. On the electric side, this would be largely the fuel and purchase power adjustment that you would see on your bill. You retain all of those savings as well. And these fixed costs are, on the gas side, they're on the order of 25 to 30% of the bill. On the electric side, somewhat higher, perhaps 50 or 60% of the bill. But nonetheless, the efficient customer does garner most of those savings, and it's not taken away through these higher prices. The second issue I want to discuss is weather. When you apply this method of rate making to a utility, and if you make no other adjustments to the formula, it has the effect of removing from the utility the variability in its profits that's associated with variability in weather, something we can call the weather risk. And under traditional rate making, that weather risk is placed on the utility. In a very mild winter, for example, sales are lower and profits are lower. In a very extreme winter, sales are higher and profits are higher. Some people think if you've taken the risk away from the utility that you must be shifting it to the customer, but in fact, that's not true. This is one of those rare circumstances in regulation where the utility and the customers are actually on the same side of the problem. And the customers share that risk with the utility. If you've placed the weather risk on the utility, you've placed it on the customer, because it's the customers that pay those higher bills in the extreme weather or the lower bills in the mild weather. What is interesting, though, if you've done that, is what you're really doing is a wealth transfer between customers and utilities. It's sort of a regulatory game of gotcha. If you get really cold weather, the utility makes out like a bandit and the customers lose. If you get really mild weather, then the customers win and the company suffers. But there seems to be no other public policy served by imposing weather risk on the customers and the utility. And there's a real cost to the customers of having the weather risk, not to the utility, but to the customers, because the cost of capital, the cost of borrowing money, and the returns required to be paid to the shareholders are a function of the variability of the profits of the company. And when you reduce that variability, it opens the door to capture some savings through the cost of capital. This can be done in a way that prevents a reduction in earnings to the shareholders while still gaining the full value of that savings to the customers. I won't go into the details of that here, but it's one of those situations where you can capture a benefit for the customer and not harm the shareholder in the process. So those are the... one other point about weather. It's not a very low-income friendly policy to impose this risk on the customer and the utility, because the low-income customers are least able to pay the bills when the weather is extreme, and that's when the bills would be slightly higher because of this risk. So it's another reason, I think, to allow decoupling, to not just decouple from the effects of energy efficiency, but to decouple from the effects of weather as well. I want to finally just note that we don't decouple the customers. The customers continue to have volumetric pricing, so that their individual bills are a function of their consumption. We don't just raise the prices to some fixed average so that everyone pays the same amount. You still pay by the kilowatt or the kilowatt hour, depending on what rate class you're in, and by the decatherm on the gas system. So you don't really disturb the existing pricing structure other than this minor modification to prices that takes place periodically. Finally, I just want to generally put this in a policy context. The existing system that we have really places the utilities' incentive structures at odds with public policy. And I think our challenge is to rethink regulation in a way that creates a business model for the utility where it maximizes its profits, fulfilling the public policy objectives that we all agree are good for society. Right now, we don't do that. Right now, the utility maximizes its profits really at the expense of customers and the expense of society. And if we can reorient that incentive structure so that the utility's profit motives are in line with these other public policy objectives, I think we're all better off for it. And that's really what decoupling is about, is creating, opening the door, if you will, for that sort of incentive structure to be in place. There is a separate issue of whether or not you need additional incentives to the utility, and that's part of creating this profit opportunity for them. Decoupling removes a negative incentive, this loss that the utility would take from reduced consumption. But it doesn't create a new profit opportunity to replace the existing one. Minnesota does have the Conservation Improvement Plan framework, which provides incentives to the utilities. That's a good thing. I think you need to consider whether or not that's adequate. Perhaps you need a more aggressive incentive program, or one that's more oriented toward linking the company's return opportunities to specific types of investments and end results in terms of energy efficiency, goal-oriented energy efficiency programs. The point being that it's a package deal. You've got to get rid of this disincentive problem, and then you need to replace it with some formula, some mechanism for the utility to make money. They're not going to stay in business if they're not making money, and we want them to make money if they're doing the things we want them to do. So I think that's why decoupling is such an important part of this puzzle. Mr. Chairman, I think that concludes my remarks, and I'm happy to answer any questions of the committee. Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shirley. A couple of things stuck out for me, and they both involve big bucks. So I'll ask, the first one is, in the example that you talked about, you said if we assume that the utility is entitled to recover $1 million from this particular rate class, my how is that? My understanding is that that amount is currently part of the rate-making decision, and so that this is really just moving from that decision to the next step. Am I correct in understanding that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, that's basically correct. When you do a regular rate case, that's exactly the steps you go through. You determine what the revenue requirement is for that class, and you divide by the consumption units, and you get a price. What decoupling does is it recalculates that last step periodically between major rate cases so that the utility stays closer to its allowed rate of return between the rate cases. But it's exactly the same effect you would get if you waited 5 years and went through the process again. When you made that calculation at that point, you would get all of the effect of these little decoupling adjustments all at one time. So, in effect, it's just a smoother way to adjust for this phenomenon, doing it monthly, quarterly, whatever, rather than waiting until the next rate case occurs.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Shirley and Mr. Chair. Less a follow-up than a pivot to sort of the next level of economies of scale here. My conversations with our utility partners here in Minnesota tell me that there's a lot of interest in moving to this, that in truly decoupling and providing more incentives to do what they want to do, which is save energy, provide reliable, clean electricity at the lowest cost alternative. Can you talk a little bit about the market forces and the sort of global the global change that we're seeing in energy and utilities specifically in terms of, I mean, where's Wall Street coming down on issues like carbon and efficiency and these major big buck opportunities?
Mr. Shirley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think there's no doubt that in the near future there's going to be some form of carbon regulation in the U.S. There's a growing consensus to that effect. But regardless of whether you believe that that's going to take place, the indicators are that Wall Street now believes that. And once Wall Street believes that, it becomes a financial issue for the utilities. Just this week, you may have seen in the press a big story about Texas Utilities and KKR doing a leveraged buyout. And part of that deal involved taking off of the table 8 coal fired power plants, taking it from 11 to 3 that the company has proposed to build. I wouldn't be surprised if those 3 eventually are taken off the table in the face of more aggressive renewable energy and energy efficiency solutions for Texas utilities. I believe that represents those investors recognizing the environmental risk, the carbon risk, as being too high for them to be comfortable with. So they're really looking for solutions that avoid that level of financial risk. Between that and what we've seen in other areas, the insurance industry is often one that steps up to recognize risks. It's not quite as apropos here, but there may be financial derivative markets and such that operate in the same sort of way that are going to be uncomfortable with taking on these kinds of risks. Or they'll take them on, but at a very extreme price. And so I think the bottom line is, when you look at these alternatives for addressing carbon going forward, the cost per ton of reducing carbon by, for example, capturing carbon from a coal plant and sequestering it, which is a technology that's emerging but not really yet deployed, versus avoiding the carbon in the first instance through energy efficiency, the costs are quite dramatic. Rather than the 8 or 10 cents I talked about earlier for a regular coal plant, you may be talking about 12 or 14 cents for that power plant to have sequestration of its carbon. Again, versus the 2 or 3 cents a kilowatt hour that we typically see right now for energy efficiency. The short answer is we should continue to be buying as much energy efficiency as we can lay our hands on until the next kilowatt hour of energy efficiency costs as much or more than these other clean technologies that we could use in lieu of that. It's difficult for people to often believe that there's that much energy efficiency out there, but in every state where we've seen aggressive energy efficiency programs, they continue to capture the savings that people just didn't believe were really there. California, I hate to use California as an example because they do so many things wrong, but when you look at what they've done with energy efficiency, it's really quite remarkable. They began aggressively buying energy efficiency in the mid-70s, and today their per capita energy use in California is the same as it was back in the mid-70s, while the U.S. per capita has gone to twice what the California usage levels are. This is driven not just by energy efficiency. There's other dynamics in that marketplace, but it's largely due to the effect of energy efficiency. So benefits are big. The potential is big. We've had regulatory and policy problems, I think, that present barriers to that, and that's what this is about.
Representative Palin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick point of information for the committee. The per capita consumption for California being static, Minnesota does track right along with the national per capita consumption rate, so we have opened up that big alligator jaw up on the climb, and we know that we can. The governor's called on us to get back down to something at least status quo from where we are here.
Mr. Shirley, could you, my understanding is that you have been sort of intimately involved in some of these issues and, in the states across the country. Could you talk a little bit about the kinds of resistance and barriers that you have encountered in these instances, and what we can do to overcome them?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification: are you talking about resistance to decoupling or resistance to energy efficiency because of the incentive problem?
I'm talking about decoupling.
Decoupling. I think there's. When you look at the gas and electric industry, it really breaks pretty cleanly between those two industries. There's two sets of issues going on. They're driven by the same underlying concept. The gas industry, over the past decade or more, has seen declining use per customer on average. So between rate cases, the revenues from their customer base go down, and therefore their profits go down. So they have a constant erosion of profits between rate cases. It puts a lot of pressure on them to come in for more rate cases. It also puts a lot of pressure on them to do the minimum effort on energy efficiency because they're already in dire straits from that. On the electric side, the opposite is basically true. On average, the use per customer is rising, revenues per customer are rising, so holding all other things constant, profits tend to go up between rate cases. This is why, frankly, sometimes you see electric utilities that haven't been in for a rate case in 10 or 15 or 20 years. They're taking advantage of this natural accretion of profits, and their revenues are rising faster than their overall expense levels, and they have no real interest in coming in. They're somewhat less resistant in theory to energy conservation and efficiency because now they're, as a friend of mine would say, this is a high-class problem when you've got lots of profits and you're dealing with whether you're going to make a lot more or just a little bit more. So the dynamics are a little different, but fundamentally there's opposition from the electric industry to decoupling because it takes away this windfall. Now, there are techniques you can use to address that. Where instead of a constant revenue per customer value, you can give this value a slope over time to make it less painful for the utility. But I think the better solution is to, as I said earlier, beef up the incentive structure for energy efficiency so that a utility can make as much money investing in energy efficiency as it could have made investing in a supply side resource. So now, if you have that situation, I think the electric utilities would become much more amenable to decoupling on their side. We are seeing, California already has decoupled all of its electric utilities. Pepco, which serves Maryland and Delaware and Washington, D.C., that area, has filed for electric decoupling, the sort of the plain vanilla version I described. National Grid, which is in Massachusetts, I've had discussions with employees there. It appears that they're about to embark on decoupling, a decoupling filing with their commission. So there are electric utilities around the country that are coming to grips with this. And I think it's largely because they're facing constrained systems. They're going to be forced to come to the commissions to build new power plants and probably new transmission lines. These are difficult to do in many parts of the country. There's a lot of NIMBYism, especially when it comes to transmission lines. And so it's a difficult thing now to add a supply-side resource, and that actually drives up the cost even more. So the economics are getting so disjointed between how cheap efficiency is and how expensive supply, new supply is, that the electric utilities are coming to grips with this and are starting to say, well, we're going to have the energy efficiency. And if we're going to have the energy efficiency, then we want the decoupling. Because if they don't get the decoupling, they're in the same boat that the gas industry's in, and they'll be suffering from lower profits.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Sorry, Representative Bruce.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Mr. Shirley answered my question. You had it, but I want to say I wish you were here tomorrow when I'm presenting my bill at the Global Warming Litigation Act. You made a great case for me.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative.
It may be, Mr. Shirley, if the weather forecast turns out to be accurate, we'll be here tomorrow. If there are no further questions, thank you very much. We really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the agenda, Ms. Brukas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Ilza Brukas. I'm manager of Alternative Resources, and I'm here representing Minnesota Energy Resources. Minnesota Energy Resources is a natural gas distribution company serving approximately 200,000 customers in 165 communities throughout the state of Minnesota. Our service territory is predominantly rural. Natural gas companies have been operating in a very unique environment. Natural gas sales have steadily decreased over time to a number of factors, such as more efficient standards for equipment, stricter building codes, better construction techniques, and natural events such as Katrina and energy policies promoting the use of natural gas as the fuel of choice for power plants has significantly contributed to large price increases and variances that have motivated many customers to further decrease their overall usage of natural gas. Natural gas resources are diminishing. There are significant concerns about climate change. Policymakers at the federal and state levels are aggressively pursuing energy efficiency to conserve a finite resource and mitigate climate change. My comments today are in support of adopting a decoupling mechanism for public utilities, especially for the natural gas companies. The adoption of a decoupling mechanism will provide benefits for both customers and the utilities. Customers will avoid the rate shock of large rate increases due to less than frequent rate cases, and the utilities will stabilize their revenue stream. While there may continue to be retail rate increases, the retail rate increases attributable to lost sales will be incrementally much smaller than the typical increase resulting from a traditional rate-making process because of the more frequent adjustments. And further, should there be a colder than normal winter, which increases sales to the utility, customers will have the benefit of lower retail rates once the decoupling mechanism is applied in a subsequent period, and as Mr. Shirley suggested, on a monthly or quarterly basis. One purpose of a decoupling mechanism is to provide revenue stability for the public utility in today's operating environment. It does not guarantee profit, nor does it remove the incentive for the public utility to continue to manage and reduce its operating costs to the greatest extent possible. The adoption and use of a decoupling mechanism is particularly important as higher and higher levels of efficiency, energy efficiency, are being used as energy policy tools to address climate change and power plant emissions. Decoupling has a black box mystique to it, and in truth, as Mr. Shirley suggested, it is only one additional step in a traditional rate-making process. I have provided for you a sample calculation of a decoupling mechanism, and you should have it before you. There are additional copies on the table. In very simple terms, I tried to develop a sample calculation on a per-customer basis and illustrate it as sales may increase or decrease and as the number of customers may stay stable or increase. In this example, the pass-through fuel costs are not part of the decoupling mechanism and are subtracted from the gross revenues to derive what is the gross margin, which is the amount of revenue before all other utility expenses such as payroll and O&M are deducted. To recognize that new customers are being added to the system and that the utility is incurring costs to serve those additional customers, the gross margin is converted to a gross margin per customer basis. In the rate case, there's the development of an approved target for the gross margin per customer basis, and any variances from this target will result in either rate increases or rate decreases under the decoupling mechanism. The sample calculation illustrates some simplified scenarios how the changes in sales and the changes in the number of customers affect the gross margin per customer number. I have documented the calculation step by step to make it as transparent for you once you go back to your offices and you analyze the example further. I have not intended to go through the example in detail here, but you may feel free to contact me, or we perhaps can go through this at this time. I have my contact information on the example. Minnesota Energy Resources believes decoupling to be an essential part of any broad-based energy policy that includes energy efficiency, climate change mitigation, and to make the best use of diminishing fuel resources without penalizing the public utility, gas, or electric. This concludes my prepared comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rugas. Before we turn to questions, I wanted to let members and members of the audience know that our Republican members of the committee are not boycotting the idea of decoupling, but rather I have been invited to an event at the governor's mansion, and in a shameful example of the misordering of priorities, I've chosen to do that. However, Representative Osmond assured me that they would listen to the recordings of the proceedings, and Mr. Marble, I'm sure that you'll see to it that they do that. So, are there questions from members? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say, if we do have Representative Rudy's controversial bill, this might be a good time to bring it up. Or any other ones that we have. Let this go through really smoothly.
Yes, we did make a few strategic errors in scheduling.
I'm really interested in this idea, and I love spreadsheets, but I won't ask you to go over everything. But if someone has a one-page fact sheet somewhere to describe this picturally somehow, the concept of decoupling, that would be really helpful.
Well, let me go through the very large basic steps of this, and that may help you decipher what the spreadsheet is attempting to do. In the upper leftmost corner, I have a box that's labeled in the rate case. And those are the basic determinants that are determined in the traditional rate-making process. You have approval of fuel costs. You have approval of a sales forecast. From that, you derive what would be the dollars per cents per kilowatt hour for the fuel. That generates an overall revenue stream, and then there are approved retail rates. Now, you could use this sheet either as representing a generic example of an entire company or a customer class or a subclass. That's how flexible this could be. I have here the labels kilowatt hour, but you could readily substitute firms in this example. Now, as Mr. Shirley suggested, that in a rate case, that's just a snapshot. Then we enter the real world and how sales actually occur. So in line one, I have created basically four scenarios. We have the rate case, which establishes a level of sales, assumed customer account, and then in that rate case, from that rate case information, line six, there's the additional step that needs to be done, and it's calculation of the gross margin on a per customer basis. The scenarios that I have created, there are four. I did a variation varying the two principal variables. Line one, I varied the sales. And in line two, I varied the customers. So in scenario A and B, I show scenario A, increase of sales, same number of customers. Scenario B, less, a smaller number of sales as compared to the rate case and the same number of customers. Scenario C is an increase of sales as compared to the rate case and also an increase in customers as compared to the rate case. The final scenario is a decrease in sales as compared to the rate case and an increase in customer counts as compared to the rate case. And scenario D, you know, based on successful energy efficiency efforts, is probably the most likely scenario that you would experience under decoupling. Now, the target gross margin per customer, line six, that's $6 in this example. That's the target. As you go through these scenarios, you calculate the gross margin on a per customer basis and compare it to that target. If it's over or under, you make adjustments to the retail rates in a subsequent period, and the customers are going up slightly or going down slightly, and that's illustrated in line 13. The changes are not very large to rates. The delta in line 14, as you can see, they're in the magnitude of a third of a penny, a tenth of a penny. And just for your information, how these scenarios change between the sales and the number of customers, line 15, I provide for you the average use. So you can see how it varied from the assumed usage in the rate case, which was 100, and then as you varied the two principal variables, you'll see the usage going up or going down and how that was reflected in the retail rate adjustment. Each line has, I have also provided the documentation of how each line was documented. For example, the gross margin is line number three, less line number four, so that you're able to replicate the calculations that I have here.
Representative Gardner, have you followed that?
A little bit, Mr. Chair, but I don't want to hold up the committee. My next-door neighbor, Representative Kalin, I'm sure will be able to explain this to me over lunch or coffee.
Representative Kalin.
Representative Gardner and Ms. Rukas, right?
Yes.
I believe we may want to set up a little walkthrough individually or maybe over the course of lunch before we formally hear the bill for interested members, and I'll set that up, and we can work together, I hope, to do so, because I think it's really important that we understand the nitty-gritty of it, and I have to be honest that I want to make sure that I understand every single cell on here as well. So, thank you.
Further questions, members? Thank you very much, and we will pursue this in some detail. Thank you. Mr. Dougherty, Center Point.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hilty, representatives. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Jeff Dougherty. I'm the Director of Regulatory and Government Affairs for CenterPoint Energy, Minnesota Gas Operations. Among my responsibilities are managing the conservation program for CenterPoint. Joining me here today is Ms. Angie Klein. Ms. Klein is the manager of our conservation programs. And in the very real possibility that you folks have some detailed questions that I can't answer, Ms. Klein certainly can, so that's why she's here today. We are here today to testify in favor of decoupling, and what I'd like to do is briefly set a little background on our conservation programs, a little bit of background on our utility bill, and hopefully that gives a little bit of perspective of why we are in favor of decoupling. Very quickly, conservation programs in Minnesota have been operating since 1992. That's when the law was passed. Since that point in time, we have spent, CenterPoint Energy has spent $85 million of conservation. But more importantly, we have saved 9 BCF of gas. Now, that's jargon, but what that basically means is that that's enough energy to heat 90,000 homes annually in the state of Minnesota. We've had about 27% of our customer base participate. And our program has been recognized nationally. And I think it's important for you as policymakers to realize that the conservation programs in Minnesota is something that we all should be very proud of. They have been held up as a shining light. Granted, there may be some that argue California is equal or maybe slightly better, but we certainly have done a good job in Minnesota, and I think that's a credit to the public policymakers. Page 2. To illustrate is if we equate our energy savings to a percentage of our throughput, we have averaged since 1999 about 0.6 of our throughput as energy savings. The one year where we exceeded that and went to about 0.8% of our throughput was in 2005. And you folks may recall that was the year when the hurricanes ravaged the Gulf Coast and caused energy prices to drastically increase. And the governor asked us at that time to do some extra initiatives for schools and for low-income consumers, and we worked with the government agencies to do that. Page 3 is just a brief overview of our current conservation program. Our budget's about $8.4 million. That money is split approximately evenly between residential and business customers. We plan on having about 32,000 customers participate in our program this year. 80% of those customers will be residential customers. 20% of those customers will be business customers. And our goal is to save 880,000 dekatherms of gas. Most of those energy savings will come from our business class, about 80%. So while only 20% of our business class participate in the conservation programs, they generate 80% of the savings. I'm going to skip over page 4. That's there for your review at your leisure, that just reiterates what I just described to you. Page 5 lays out briefly how natural gas gets served to customers in Minnesota. I think it's important because it lends an understanding of what's in a natural gas bill. Starting at the oil well or the gas and going through the processing plant and interstate pipeline, that is 70% of the customer's bill. Those costs are either the commodity cost of the gas itself, or it is pipeline transportation that's regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. From the point where it comes to the natural gas company to the point it goes to our consumers, that's approximately 30% of our customers' bill. And those are the costs that we have investments in the state of Minnesota that are regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Page 6 tries to just depict this slightly differently. The top part of this natural gas plane represents the distribution costs that we have here in the state of Minnesota, that 20 or 30% of our cost that is rate regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. The bottom part of the flame represents the 70 to 80% of the cost, or either the commodity itself or the transportation cost that we pay to the interstate pipelines to get the gas to Minnesota. How the gas is billed is a separate question. On the top half of the flame, About 40% of those costs are billed on a fixed basis. You folks may be aware of that. That's the customer charge, the basic charge that's in the utility bill. The rest of those charges are billed on a volumetric basis, as well as are the gas costs are billed on a volumetric basis. And there is where we start getting the rub on asking utilities to save more energy. Because when the utility saves more energy, a lot of our costs are recovered in a volumetric basis. And so when customers don't use that gas, it hurts our bottom line. Page 7, what I'd like to do here now is transition to decoupling. And here is the dynamic that, as the manager of a conservation program, that I run into constantly at a utility company. 9 of the past winters have been warmer than normal. And for a natural gas utility company, what we have experienced is most of that has occurred in the first quarter of our year. So if we start the first quarter of our year in the hole, and people say, why should we save more energy and just exacerbate our problem? That's the rub that we run into. You know, we are a for-profit business. And when we help customers save, it does take away from our bottom line. So what really is the essence of a successful conservation program, from my perspective, is that it depends upon motivated people in a committed organization to deliver that. If an organization has disincentives removed and the people feel committed that this is a good public policy, which it is good public policy to go out and save energy, then it will get done. Page 8 illustrates the weather pattern. I'm not going to belabor this very long. The solid line that goes across the graph is 20-year normal weather, and the part of the graph that bops up and down is the actual weather, and you can see where 9 of the last past years have been warmer than normal. Page 9 illustrates, I think another witness may have talked to this, about natural gas usage declining. And this is a dynamic that I think does separate us from the electric business. The graph on the left illustrates how net electric usage for residential customers has been going up. And the graph on the right illustrates how since 1971 there has been a precipitous drop for natural gas on how much gas our customers use. So if you take weather combined with this declining use per customer into consideration, those are the dynamics that a decoupling mechanism would address and remove that disincentive. You know, with that disincentive removed, I'm confident that CenterPoint Energy will do all it can to achieve as much energy savings as possible. So with that, I'm available for questions.
Questions from members, Representative Kalen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an explanation of the decoupling, a win-win single page that was passed around in response to Representative Gardner's request. Incredibly fast. These trios these days that are keeping the energy consumption going up are actually very useful. And I have trio thumb. No, actually, thank you for providing the one page. And I would just direct members to the legislation paragraph in the center of it that I think very clearly describes what the legislation would do, that right along the side of what Mr. Shirley was explaining, that quick periodic adjustments that don't require the difficulty of going through actual rate making.
Mr. Doherty, could you explain what elements are responsible for the dramatic decline that we observe on page 9?
Certainly, Chairman Hilty. I think there are a lot of things that contribute to this. One of the things that I like to point to, it's kind of anecdotal, I know, but my house was built 40 years ago, and it was constructed out of 2x4 construction. Most of the new construction we have today are 2x6 construction. The building envelopes are much, much tighter today than they were 20, 30 years ago. So So I think that's one item that contributes to it. I think the requirements of what type of mechanical equipment can be placed into customers' homes has drastically improved through the years. Instead of having 76% efficient or 76% efficient furnaces, the standard is now higher than that. So when customers automatically replace their furnaces, they're replacing their furnaces with higher efficient furnaces. So those are some of the things that I think contribute to that. Pardon? That's right. We have townhomes, we have smaller homes, and that type of thing also. But those are, I think, the things that contribute to that.
It's interesting you mentioned smaller homes. I don't think that would be the common perception. I think the actual square foot size of housing has increased dramatically over that same period of time, which is one of the reasons that I inquired about the factors that contribute to this.
Chair Hilty, the mix of new construction
that's
on it. Please
identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Angie Klein with CenterPoint Energy.
Thank you.
The mix of type of new construction has contributed. 10 years ago, it would have been about 80% single family, 20% condominiums and townhomes. And over the last 3, 4, 5 years, it's now a 40% townhome and 60% single family. And with that, and even though there's been a significant amount of new construction until recently, with that, with the shared walls, coupled with just the building standards have gone up, just that whole mix of the overall customer number of having customers have shared walls, basically, has contributed. One other factor that has contributed to the declining use per customer.
Thank you. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Hill, Representative Hilty, Mr. Chair. I think the major improvement that we've made over the last 2 or 3 decades in terms of building codes and building construction has affected our efficiency in heating. And also, I mean, even in commercial construction, we're doing a much better job with our building envelopes, with our windows, and these are gas, largely gas issues. When we're looking at every other piece of our economy, the more and more gadgets, the larger televisions, the computers, all of this is really electric. And so I think that, I mean, we need to address the electric part of the decoupling and incentive issue as well, but also just to recognize that we have gotten really good on the gas savings. And I think one example are the bills that we'll hear from Representative Peterson on Friday, where the geothermal is increasing the load on our electricity to run the pumps, but we're doing great savings on our gas. So the more that we can recognize things as a big picture, the better, but that you all have taken the brunt from our good work in energy savings. So we really appreciate your leadership on decoupling and hope that we can get something passed to help you all out, but also help the state out.
Another question would be regarding the resource itself. What is your assessment of this, of the current situation that we have and our prospects in terms of natural gas production in North America?
Chairman Hilty, I have to apologize to you. You asked me that question in your office, and I need to follow up with you and get you in that information. I do know that the demand supply curve today is still tight. That's why prices are one, quite variable, and two, fairly high. But what I will do is I will follow up for you and for everybody else in the committee from the AGA and find out what they are saying about the supply of natural gas going forward.
Well, there does seem to be kind of a disconnect between what you're showing us here is declining use at the same time that we have increasing prices, if there isn't any correspondent decrease in the supply.
Chairman Hilty, I think that's the very important reason why we need to save and use our energy wisely. Natural gas is not an infinite supply, and we do need to use the product efficiently. I hope that my kids and my grandkids have the ability to use natural gas, and that's why I think it's important for us to use the product efficiently.
If you could get that information to us, I would appreciate it, Mr. Dackney. Further questions from members? We have just about run out of time here today. If there are no further questions, we will try to squeeze in at least one more testifier, and we will have we are meeting on Friday at 2 o'clock, unless, or 2:30 rather, unless weather or session intervenes. So what we don't get to today, we will continue into Friday, but thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Dufresne here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Chris Dufresne. I am Assistant Director of the Energy Sense Coalition. We're a coalition of 30 organizations that work to keep energy affordable in Minnesota. We represent fixed and low-income customers. I direct the efficiency programs at Energy Sense. I also testify as a witness in utility rate cases, so I understand what you're going through on this issue of decoupling, because I have to prepare testimony on it right now, and it keeps me up at night, believe me. First, I want to make clear that as an energy consumer group, we support some forms of decoupling, and that's a significant statement because many consumer organizations, ratepayer advocates, and attorneys generals do not support it. We support decoupling that promotes the clear public policy purpose of promoting energy efficiency investments, and we do this for two reasons. One is that utilities under decoupling will be more likely to invest in energy efficiency programs, which the people we represent can benefit from. And second, utilities frequently cite declining usage due to energy efficiency as one of the key reasons they advocate for higher customer service charges. Those are those fixed charges we get on our bill. They advocate for those in rate cases. And high fixed charges are bad for conservation, and they're also bad for low-usage customers. And low-income customers are, on average, low-usage customers. So that's an important point for us. But as always with us, a consumer group like us and utilities, when we're in the same room, there's always going to be some disagreement. And let me tell you a little bit about what the rub is, although I think a lot of the rub is, or really the rub itself, has been worked out in the last hours in terms of language that you're going to see next week. Or whenever you bring it up in this committee. I'm not exactly sure when that is.
We think it's next week.
Okay. The key difference we have is the issue of who should receive the weather risk, and Mr. Shirley did bring this up earlier. And the shift of weather risk from utilities to customers is a significant issue. We would disagree respectfully with Mr. Shirley on this, that removing weather risk from utilities is necessarily good for consumers. What it does is it levelizes bills. It brings down bills in cold winters, and it would bring up bills in warmer winters. We think there's better ways to levelize bills. The key way being something like a budget plan. The thing we hear from consumers is the more important thing is to keep bills affordable, more than levelizing their bills. They want affordable bills across the board. So that's a key issue for us. And as winters get warmer and warmer, as they have on trend, and you've heard about that, we can expect automatic rate adjustments upward if we allow for a weather adjustment on our bills. Another issue that's been raised as a reason for this would be that the cost of no rate case is the cost of having a rate case is significant, and it is. I won't lie about that. We're in there in a room where where there's a number of attorneys on the other side arguing something different. So we know that, that the cost is significant. But if we don't allow for frequent rate cases, if we don't allow for us to examine their books, and more importantly, really, the regulators, the Department of Commerce, and the Public Utilities Commission themselves, we often lose if we don't have frequent rate cases. And there's some very important things that come out of rate cases. For us, we've been able to make improvements and increase resources for low-income people through affordability programs, conservation programs. Other players have negotiated other things. The Chamber of Commerce recently was able to get more information on energy prices from a utility, and that was a result of a rate case settlement. Those are important things. In addition, really, the Department of Commerce in their analysis often brings down rate increases that aren't just and is able to find those savings for all consumers, and that's an important thing. So when you hear the argument that we want to do something so that we don't have to do costly rate cases, that should send up a flag, I think, for you. Most importantly, is the issue of the cost of capital. Well, when you talk about shifting risk from the utility to the consumer, you're talking about a great shift in the cost of capital. And I just want to highlight quickly what that is. What you do is any kind of decoupling proposal is that you're creating steadier cash flows for the utility. And when that happens, their bond ratings rise. And that could be, that's been presented today as a very good thing, and I actually do agree. That is a good thing. It makes debt cheaper. It means utilities are able to take on more debt. Debt is cheaper than stockholder equity. And so there's definitely potential for win-win for consumers and for utilities on that. However, if those costs are not passed on to ratepayers, either through a rate case or through some other mechanism, then customers do not win out, and what we're merely doing is creating a windfall for utilities. And that's what we want to avoid. And I think we can avoid this. I think we've worked out some language that's going to be that's going to put a lot of these issues into the commission's agenda more than yours, which is probably a benefit to you. I'm not sure if it is for the commission. But I think we can
actually create a lot more than we do.
That's a good point. But traditionally, we have not been able to address the cost of capital outside of a rate case. And if we're going to decouple outside of a rate case, then we need to be able to address the cost of capital as well. That's very important. So a lot of this debate over weather risk, I think, will be left to the commission. I think what we've worked out between the utilities and ourselves is going to work in terms of creating a very clear definition of what decoupling is, and that your intent in passing decoupling is to improve energy efficiency. And we're all behind that. And I think that's where the real win-win is for customers and for utilities. So we look forward to following that debate, making sure that we keep that all together, and I think we can pass something good this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffery. We look forward to the debate as well. Members, normally we have to be out of this room right on time because there's a Republican caucus scheduled for 4 o'clock, but I have a feeling it's not going to take place today. In which case, Mr. Crocker, unless you were planning on a half-hour testimony here, why don't we squeeze you in and save you braving the elements on Friday, as if you would not anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Crocker. I'm with the North American Water Office, and I really am pleased to be here and testifying about this issue. I became aware of the competing incentives over 20 years ago when we started to understand that if if the societal interest is in using energy efficiently, why, that's in contradiction with the company interest in making money by selling more of it. And as we started to grapple with this issue in the mid-80s, why, two things happened that sort of derailed us for getting to this kind of a discussion then. And one was the whole deregulation of the energy market in general nationally. And the other thing was a real specific thing that happened with NSP at the time over Prairie Island and nuclear waste. But we actually did in that time have worked towards with NSP a mechanism on the demand side of their rate base that really was kind of a decoupling instrument. It had a separate rate of return for the conservation rate base that was tied to not just how much money they spent on it, but how much energy they actually saved. And as we tried to move forward with that type of thinking about how to apply it to the entire rate base, those two things came in our way. And so it's taken this long to get back to that kind of a discussion. And I am just really, really pleased that we can now have it, bearing in mind that there are these low income, these equity issues that we have to be mindful as we do it. But I'd just like to take a couple minutes to maybe help frame is how to think about this issue. And it's sort of like it took me 10 full years to figure out when the utility said cost effective, they meant something entirely different than what I meant when I said cost effective. And decoupling gets to the heart of it. Let's just say that what we want to do is keep food cold in our refrigerator. That's the function we want performed. And there's two ways to do it. We can either get a more efficient refrigerator that uses less energy to keep it cold, and let's say that option costs us 2 cents per kilowatt hour to do that over a period of time. Or the other way to do it is to build another power plant to keep our old inefficient refrigerator operating, but that costs, say, 3 cents per kilowatt hour over time to do that. So the question is, which is the cost-effective option? And the answer is, depends on who you are. Because if you are the utility, and that 2 cent option may be cost-effective for you, but as it erodes your earnings, it's not cost-effective for the utility. So in other words, we have competing interests in terms of how we provide utility services. The societal interest is diametrically opposed to the corporate or the company interest, and it doesn't matter if you're an investor-owned utility or a REA, a Rural Electrification Co-op, or a municipal. If your financial health as a company is tied to the consumption of energy rather than its efficient use, the contradiction stands. And so what we're doing here with this decoupling discussion and legislation will be to help resolve a long-standing fundamental contradiction between business interests and societal interests. And as we do that, bearing in mind the equity issues, bearing in mind the low-income issues, like anything else, there's a couple of right ways to do stuff, and there's a whole lot of wrong ways to do it. And the challenge will be to find the right ways to do this. But finally, we're getting to the point of understanding how we can actually reward the behavior we want. Those of us who have raised children know that we tend to get the behavior we reward with our kids. And if we reward them when they call us nasty names, we're going to get called nasty names. Well, same with the utilities. If we reward consumption, which is what we've been doing, that's what we get. And then we have to struggle to achieve a different objective through a SIP process or some other process that's in contention. Here we're aligning those interests. And I really look forward to this discussion, and I'm very, very grateful, Mr. Chairman, for your leadership in helping bring this forward and for the good thinking around this committee table to help us have that discussion in a way that does align societal interests with the business interests of those who provide us with the electric utility services. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crock. Questions to the witness? Okay. Anyone in the audience wish to add a few words at this point? Seeing none, the meeting is adjourned.